Late Night Live. Ideas and opinions from around the world.
Hello and welcome to Late Night Live. And no, it's not Philip. John Cleary with you, standing in for Philip Adams tonight, who's off on a very important family engagement. A very diverse program this evening. In a few moments, we'll be talking with defence and security analyst Alan DuPont about the Rudd government's assessment of Australia's national security directions over the next 20 years. And we shall end the evening with a reflection on earwigs and other things, both entomological and etymological, when we meet scientist and author Mary R. Berenbaum. But first, we start with a small matter of food security. And for one group of Pacific Islands, that's become an immediate challenge. As each day passes, we're hearing more terrible stories of whole villages wiped out by the tsunami that hit Samoa and Tonga. And we're yet to learn the full extent of the loss of life. We're also yet to learn the extent of the loss of agricultural land vital to the island's local communities and economies. Many of the crops in Pacific Islands are grown in a narrow band of arable coastal land, exactly the lands most vulnerable to the effects of a tsunami. In a minute, we'll hear from Les Baxter. Les is Horticulture Research Program Manager with the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research, and he's in Samoa as part of their work on improving the resilience of agricultural systems. Also with us is Mark Rose Grant, Director of the Environment and Production Technology Division at the International Food Policy Research Institute. And they've just released a report which looks at the impact of climate change on food production. It predicts a major increase in the number of malnourished children by the year 2050. Mark Rose Grant is a co-author of that report, and he joins us from Bangkok, while Les Baxter is on the phone from Apia in Samoa. And Les, I must ask you first about the conditions in Samoa at the moment. You were there through the impact of the earthquake and then the tidal wave. Have you been able to see the devastation on the southern side of the island?
No, John. Look, the situation is that we came here to some scoping for some projects that we're going to do, actually associated, I guess, with food security. We were in Apia, and Apia wasn't directly affected, although we had a warning here. So we haven't directly seen what's happened, though we've heard some pretty bad stories.
Of course, one of the things that is amply demonstrated by what happened yesterday is the effect of salt water in flooding lowland areas. And of course, coastal areas are where much of the agricultural production goes on in island communities. So I guess there is an implication that can be drawn.
Well, yes. In a lot of these island nations, really agriculture really revolves around, food security revolves around small garden and village culture. And as you've said, a lot of those regions are very close to the coast. They're really just really susceptible to any form of disaster, be it sea level rise or tsunami or cyclones. And so any of those sort of shocks can cause some major problems in the food security.
So what happens? It's the salt intrusion into otherwise freshwater agricultural land that just basically renders it unusable.
Well, it really depends on the salt type and a whole range of factors as to how bad that effect is. I mean, the initial effect is it's just the total devastation of the crops. So the crops are wiped out. In the case of vegetables, for many months in the very least. In the case of fruit and vegetable crops, it'll be several years before they're planted and come back into bearing. So that can have quite a big effect. Things like coconuts and breadfruit, you know, they'll be many years before they can come back into fruiting again. And then you do have the effect if there's salt water lying around, that can cause a problem for some years as well. So it can be quite complicated. And it's just the shock of those sort of things, particularly in communities where traditionally they don't store a whole lot of food stuff. So it's not like rice and wheat where you can store a bit of grain. A lot of the fundamental food crops here are root crops, where you can store them in the ground to some extent, but really they're not stored that much from season to season.
Well, Mark Rosengrant, let me bring you into the conversation here. Tell us about the report that you've issued, because in it you've looked at the effects of climate change on crop production as far ahead as 2050 and compared it to crop production without climate change. Now, how much difference is there in the two models?
Well, yeah, that's right. In fact, we're finding huge negative impacts of climate change on crop production for developing countries, as much as 15 to 20% shortfalls on rice production, 20% on maize, and as much as 40% declines in wheat production out to 2050. And that, in turn, induces really significant increases in food prices, which then reduces consumption, particularly the poor who spend so much of their income on staple crops. And that in turn leads to the significant increases in malnutrition and food insecurity, which you noted at the beginning of the report.
The negative effects of climate change on crop production are especially pronounced in areas like South Asia and semi-arid countries like sub-Saharan Africa. Where else can we expect to see real problems with food growth?
You know, we also found very negative impacts, for example, in Indonesia, where in particular the changes in monsoon and increased temperatures are going to reduce rice production particularly substantially, and also maize production. We also did some additional work on modeling the impact of sea level rise, and we see that areas such as the Mekong Delta in Vietnam could lose as much as 30% of Vietnam's rice area due to a 1 meter sea level rise, and additional huge negative impacts also in the deltas of Bangladesh as well. So that sea level rise on top of these direct impacts on production could really be devastating.
Is there anywhere where calorie availability is expected to increase without climate change?
Without climate change, yeah, we do see long-term improvements in calorie consumption with the because we do look at long productivity increases and income increases as well. So you do get increases without climate change, but those are pretty well shut off when you get the price increases due to climate change.
Mm. Baxter, let me come back to you for a moment, and without building on your immediate experience, let's talk about your wider experience. What are some of the key challenges for food production in the Pacific Islands, given the projected rise in sea levels that may come with climate change?
Yeah, look, I guess there's two situations, John. One is for the atoll islands, and with the atoll islands, they face special problems in that they're essentially sand islands, and many of them sit on a lens of fresh water. So with sea level rises, you've got the sea level incursion onto the coastal plains, but also you end up with seawater incursion into the waterlands, and so you find that you have all those sorts of problems. And, you know, with climate change, if you're a volcanic-based island and you have some altitude, you have some potential to go up and down the mountain a little bit and therefore get some variation in climate, you know. But when you're on a flat, fairly flat atoll island, there's no ability to do that, and so any change in climate is really quite a major effect. That combined with the fact that the atoll islands are inherently fairly infertile because they're basically sand, means that the atoll islands really are a major problem with regard to any effects like climate change and those sort of things that are going to really impact on their ability to grow their own food.
Mm. Local production of food crops in Pacific Island countries makes up a huge percentage of household income, as we've already alluded to. I understand in the Solomon Islands it's up around 71%, in Samoa and Tonga it's about 40%, and as indicated in Mark's report, one of the important issues around crop production is the ability for farmers to transform what they're doing into sustainable income-gathering activities. So just assuring them that they can at least live above the poverty level. What are some of the strategies that can be employed in Pacific Islands to do that? Are we looking at the capacity, any capacity for people to improve their lot?
Yeah, look, at the end of the day, food security is a complicated issue, and it's not just about the ability to be able to grow what you need, it's about the ability to be able to procure what you need. And so And then there are other things like the need for education, clothing, medical, all those sort of things. So the thing to be able to do is to engage farmers closer in the market so that they can actually get some farm income, household income, so that they can then buy what else they need. And so we're looking at a number of strategies. We're looking at diversification. So we're looking at different ranges of crops. So, for example, in the Solomon Islands, growers that are close to the markets of Honiara can actually do pretty well out of a different range of high-value vegetables. So, for example, they can grow cabbages and tomatoes and those sort of things in addition to their traditional crops and make a bit of money that way. Places like Fiji and PNG, we're looking at flour production, and the women can make quite a good money out of a small area selling flowers to the local markets for hospitality and for tourism, for example. So those sort of diversifications are things that we're looking at. We're also, ACR is a research and development based organisation, so what we're doing is trying to work with local research organisations to build capacity so that they can increase their yields and also so that they can look at strategies to mitigate the effects of climate change, like increasing pests and diseases, drought and water management. So those sort of issues. So there's a lot that can be done. And look, I'm greatly encouraged by the report and what it has to say and fully support what its findings are.
Well, Mark Rosengrant, you've been looking at the $7 billion here with the report you recommend. You're currently attending the International Climate Change meetings in Bangkok in the lead-up to the Copenhagen meetings in December, and one of your key recommendations is to make agricultural adaptation a key agenda point within the international climate negotiation process. To most of us, this is a pretty obvious agenda item, but so much can get shifted to the corners when politics gets involved.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in the recent past, the agriculture has been pushed to the side quite a bit, and you know, in looking at the hardcore energy sectors. But I think now we are seeing it rising back to serious attention. That there's been a lot of work by not only us but many other international institutions trying to make the case for agriculture is a very important recipient of adaptation financing. And it does seem now it's getting much more attention among the negotiators. So I'm becoming cautiously optimistic that there is some progress on this issue for agriculture.
As a result of your research, you estimate that another $7 billion US per year on top of the aid already given would avert our bleak future. But this again runs up against the imperative of politics and the willingness of nations to accept a greater sense of global responsibility. It's very hard to be optimistic in the light of what's been going on recently.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think we have to keep pushing. And you know, I guess I still hope that if the voices in the analysis are strong enough that this can move people in the right direction. And I think it's also important to note that not only the international community, but the countries themselves have to step up the plate and increase their own budgetary resources going to agriculture. And you said it's a long road to hoe, but we're sort of keeping at it.
Les Baxter and Mark Rosengrant, we can only thank you for your work and trust that those at Copenhagen will not ignore it. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Mark Rosengrant and Les Baxter, you're on Late Night Live. This is John Cleary with you, filling in for Philip Adams.